It's Maya Wolf and Liz Lavender interviewing Howie. Can you tell us when you first knew about No Fit State and when you first got involved with them?
So the first time I got to see No Fit State Circus, I can't quite remember what year it was, but I know it will show up in the history because it was the Dodo Island show, and it was a Glastonbury festival. I saw it a number of times that year, but I first saw it at Glastonbury Festival and ended up chatting to Linda and Gregoire Carell afterwards. And I'd got quite a serious interest in circus going on at that particular point in my life. But after spending an hour or so with them, possibly in the backstage circus bar, but possibly just in the No Fit State tent after the show, I felt like No Fit State Circus was the circus I wanted to join. But it wasn't until 98 that Lynn Carroll suggested to me and Barnes that we come down and volunteer on Now Here, the community project, which was running in the warehouse in Curran Embankment down in Cardiff. And we first came along and joined in with the production side of things. We met Riley and we were bracing stages for him, building steel deck staging, putting up scaffolding, building curtain lines for Sean Donohoe, doing all sorts of the production side ready for that big community show. And then Orrit came in one lunchtime and saw us messing about on our stilts, putting up the scaffolding, leaping from stage to stage and generally being idiots around the inside of this warehouse, and went, oh my god, can we have those two in the show? And it seemed like the very next morning we were in with the core group of performers, which included Ali and Lynn Carroll, and Shayna and Annabelle Holland and Helen Finch. There's a whole list of people that were in on that little core group, around which the whole show then revolved. And I believe me and Barnes were late on the very first morning with Orrit, and part of that show revolved around the concept of time. And so she made all the rest of the cast surround us and inspect us like doctors, but also something to do with their watches and the time it was. And it was somewhere between the concept of the show being based in a hospital and the concept of the show being based around time as well. And we were severely picked on for about an hour. It was our very first experience with Orrit, and it was mightily unpleasant. And then we just carried on as per normal after that. We were not entirely forgiven, but obviously we were never late ever again for anything Orrit ever did ever after.
Even now.
Yeah. They crowded us like, you know, like student doctors would do. Just me and Barnes sat there. In this, I don't think we'd ever done a theatrical workshop in our entire lives, being Barnes. You know, 10 years have been idiots on the stilts, but no theatricality whatsoever. And they, she got all of them, there was about 20 of them or something, to crowd round us with notebooks and write things down about us and look at their watches and touch and inspect and write things down again.
And so then after Now Here, your involvement continued. And how did that continue? What happened after?
I think because myself and Barnes hit No Fit State from both sides, we arrived and we did the production side, the building side of things, and scaffolding and steel decking. And then we also ended up on the performance side of things, doing stilt walking and fire were probably our main two things. We just had a lot of, there were just a lot of skills going on that seemed to be wanted by No Fit State. So they were then, Ali had us on her agency books and we'd do stilt walking jobs, which I think was how we financed our first couple of voluntary months for No Fit State. Both myself and Barnes are also particularly good on tents, so we were very quickly put in on the old Blue Big Top crew, and they take us to Glastonbury every year. I did my apprenticeship, I felt, with Toby there on loading lorries, building grandstand seating, putting up big tops, taking them down again, and whatever else was really required to make things work. And then we did that.
Then we had the silver tent maybe got made.
Yeah.
And then you were quite in that core group of learning all about the silver tent, I think.
Yeah. The first time it went up was possibly 99 with Henry. Somewhere down in... Somewhere down in Somerset, and we were all, me, Barnes, Paddy Watson and Dennis France were all happened to be camped up together at the Big Green Gathering, when it used to be on the hilltop, which I can't even remember where that site is now, but somewhere down Somerset Way. And we got a call from Tom saying, Henry's putting up the Flying Saucer, which we knew was imminent. You know, we knew Tom was getting it built. And he said, can you come down on Saturday afternoon? So the four of us left the festival and went down to this field that was just a few miles up the road. And Henry and his sons, I think, had got the king poles up and had got the cupola and dome built. And that was about as far as they got. I think they got the skins laid out as well. So we then joined in for that day and the next day, I think the Sunday as well, and got the whole tent up and dressed out, which is what we call it when we put in the side poles and all the metalwork and the frill at the edge, for the very first time.
And we hadn't really a clue. I know I was there at that point as well. And we didn't really know how to put those poles in. It kind of, you know, it was lifting and pushing and clicking them in and those little pins that went in.
Yeah.
And I only know this because I remember being in bed the next day and I figured out a unique way of lifting things with a metal pole on my back so that I could shove a pole in and I would lift things up on my back
and
shove
shoulders. The pole in.
And Charlie came into the bedroom the next day and I happened to lean forward drinking my cup of tea in bed and he shrieked and he would go, "Oh my God, what's happened to your back? What's happened to your back?"
Is it bright red?
And I looked at my back.
Bruised.
It was just all these welts across. Like it just looked like I'd been whipped. Yeah. Where I had lifted, and there was just these pole marks all over my back. And at that point, that wasn't the right way to lift.
Yeah, it was heavy, that ring beam, and since then, we try and get a team of four, and they would do one section of ring beam. With that team of four, sometimes two sections.
I think two people used to push it up, and you used to shove the pole in.
And that was enough because that's quite hard work. But certainly, that first put up, it was sort of six of us did the entire tent, all six sections of it, and trying to discover the process, the techniques, and the process. And it's heavy. Mm. It's heavy and it's unpleasant, and it traps your fingers. And, all sorts of little subtleties that I think we've passed on the information, you know, this year is the first year last year was the first year I've not put it up, but passed it over to Hazel and Lyndall. But with all those little tricks and techniques that have actually just been verbally passed along the line, but we definitely learned some of them for the very first time in that field in Somerset. It was, I remember thinking, oh my God, this is like an enormous giant jigsaw puzzle, but without a picture on the box lid, so you know where you're going with it. You've just kind of got random pieces that you apparently fit together.
And then you became kind of core tent crew, didn't you? Though you four, really.
Yeah, there was certainly me, Paddy, Dennis and Barnes were very core four for a few years there. For the first 3 to 4 years.
And we did a mix of, I think the whole idea, the business plan of that tent was our own creative business and stuff and corporate gigs, and we had different outfits, different T-shirts, didn't we, for kind of our community and show work and corporate stuff. Can you remember those T-shirts?
Yeah, with the old-style logo. And I've still got one with a massive logo branded across the front.
Good, we haven't got one of those.
I don't know. Annetta has one that's pristine. It's like she's only worn it 5 times. It looked amazing. I wanted to buy it off her, but she wasn't having it. And I've got a tiny one where it's like a tiny little breast motif
of
the old school No Fit State logo.
So we're trying to make that tent work, and then you did a few corporate gigs, didn't you? Didn't you do the BMW launch somewhere?
Yeah, we did a BMW. That actually, didn't that come after the very first year of touring, the BMW launch? We did Woodpecker Cider.
Oh, that was awful.
Up in Newcastle.
Yeah.
It's awful, but entertaining in lots of ways.
We had palletfuls and palletfuls of cider. Nobody could drink, and everybody drank cider.
And Amstel Lager. That's Woodpecker cider and Amstel Lager. And both of which give you a headache after only a...
And a new product that Woodpecker were launching, which was a tequila-based Alco Pop. I can remember it was green.
Very good.
Nobody drank it.
No, I've got no recollection of that whatsoever.
Well, it's called something like Iguana.
I remember that one being on a hill up in Newcastle because I had to do a massive amount of chocking, and there's always a funny thing when you put tents on a hill as to whether you put the king poles perpendicular to the ground or vertical or somewhere between the two. Anyway, it all goes tight on one edge and it all goes saggy on the uphill side. Remember that. We did a few gigs in Cooper's Park in Cardiff.
Yeah, we did the Gay Pride.
Pride was like the very second ever put up. No doors.
That's right.
No doors for that one.
There was a youth festival as well. A youth festival one day and then the Gay Pride the next.
Yeah.
And there was about 100 people to put up the tent. Nobody knew.
I'm interested in the no doors. How does that work?
Yes. Well, we hadn't built them at that point. So there were no doors to go on. So it was just a tent with no doors. But there wasn't a massive infrastructure. I didn't remember what came in. In fact, the reason I don't remember what came in is because me and Barnes had to leg it to do a job in Alton Towers on the day of the gig. So we put it up and then run off to Alton Towers whilst the gig was on, and then we came back down and took it down again. Cush came and drove the forklift for us for that. Dave Cushway is an artist who used to work for Cardiff Council on and off.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember.
He was our forklift.
Didn't he do the ice rink?
Yes, yeah, that's Cush.
Yeah, because when we weren't working in the summer, a lot of us went to the ice rink in the winter, didn't we?
Yeah, that was a bit of a mainstay for a number of years.
What was that? Tell me more about that.
It was Cardiff's Winter Wonderland, run in front of Cardiff City Hall by Cardiff Council. But certainly for a good 10 years, 2000 to 2010, when it ran, a large portion of their skate hire staff, some of their build crew, forklift driver, Tim, as skate hire manager,
yeah,
certainly came from No Fit State Circus. Yeah, Kath. So
we were all painfully subjected to at least 2 months of 8 hours.
Nothing,
Christmas carols.
Nothing painful of the sort. It was
bloody awful.
It was not. It was great. I carried on working for that until they had to put it out to tender, and Robin Cousins Entertainment got the tender. So they lost their own thing, unfortunately. Skate hire was a bit thankless. You had to deal with everybody's smelly shoes and give them skate
whilst listening to cheery Christmas carols.
Cheery Christmas carols, yeah.
So at that point, was the circus more of a summer type affair?
Yeah.
Quieter in the winter?
Yeah, largely. Yeah, I've always found myself doing different things in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That's largely the nature of tents. It's just too cold and wet in winter to be running tents. The cost of heating is too much.
Snow on a canvas is not good.
Yeah, the snow loading is not great. Although we've done both the tents in snow.
Mm.
Done the blue tent up for Welfare State's finale gig. Up in the Lake District with the blue tent covered in snow. More or less, as soon as we got it up, it put about 2 inches of snow down on top of it, and we had to leave it there with them saying, "I'd put a heater in there if I were you." No, that was all fine. And we did, it snowed on the tent in Llanelli on one of the rehearsal periods for Immortal, or possibly Taboo. It all gets a bit hazy as to where you were at which point.
Mm. So, a quick rundown. Taboo, what shows have you worked on?
I remember.
Yeah, I don't remember it.
Well, Kadia and Petri were down in Llanelli with us, and they were in Taboo.
Yeah, that's a Taboo tour. So, quick rundown of what shows you've worked on.
I did Now Here, the community show, in the warehouse, which then 2 years later we did Immortal, the community show, or I'm Not Mortal, in the tent for the very first time. I think that was 2000, but maybe it was 2001.
It's later. It wasn't
2000. Anyway, there was another little break, then we did 2004 Immortal, the first professional touring show in the Silver Spaceship. Immortal went for 4 years. There were 4 seasons of Immortal, and then we totally revamped and came up with a brand new show called Taboo. Even though all 4 years of the Immortal were quite different, we came up with a brand new concept, Taboo, which Immortal and Taboo were both Forensic Greedy shows. For Taboo, she got completely obsessed by 100 Years of Solitude, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And so although we didn't try and tell the story, the people we were in the show were the characters of 100 Years of Solitude. The I can't remember the name of the family now. Anyway, we were those people lost in a family lost in South America somewhere for 3 years. And then the tented tour then turned into Bianco, but which we did for 2 years at Eden. The first year was called Labyrinth, and then we did Bianco as a concept, which was sort of came from a José Saramago book as a concept, I think called The Elephant's Journey. All Friends' shows have a little concept or muse behind them, and quite often they're books. So the first Immortal was a José Saramago novel called The Cave. The second Immortal was, I think, a Kurt Vonnegut book, somewhere between Slapstick and Slaughterhouse-Five. Between the two. And she actually emailed him to say, I hope you don't mind, you know, I've been reading your books, and we're doing a production which is inspired by Slaughterhouse-Five. And he actually sent her an email back saying, well, I hope you have a lot of very important fun with your production. Brilliant.
Well, that'd be nice to get.
Yeah. The third book was a Welsh author, and I can't remember his name now, but he's contemporary and current, and he's got a book that's set in Barcelona, or at least a chapter of which was set in Barcelona, and they found this community of people in this chapter in the book who lived on the rooftops of Barcelona. Now, ironically, I think that was me and Robin Collins and Freya and a whole load of Baseline Circus posse and a whole bunch of crazy anarchista Italian, Spanish, Czech, French, traveller, punk, squat crew that all had a merry time out in Barcelona for a while. And I think the author probably met all of us lot who were a chunk of Immortal No Fit State folk and went, oh my God, these people are amazing. They just seem to like live out in this crazy world. Oh. And then he wrote a chapter, and then Forenza read his book and went, oh, this is brilliant. I love these people. Let's base a show on them.
And then, they were you.
Because there's this chapter down at not Altafuia, Seachers, which comes out of this book. I'm going to have to come back on you the name of the book and the whole thing about it. But there's a thing outside a nightclub down in Seachers with a fire eater, which could quite easily be me. You know, there's not only me, there was a few of us down there doing, I don't know, I'll have to... You might have to ask Forenza that question, what that one was. And then the fourth Immortal didn't really seem to have a book, but she took the whole crew on a walk down to the gasworks in down the River Taff, just in Cardiff. I don't know if it's all been built on or not yet, but it's sort of down where IKEA is in Cardiff. There's a big old... You know, the gas works where the gas fills up in the big drum and goes down. And sometimes there's a big old metal frame left around it. She just went and looked at that big old frame and went, this is brilliant. And we built the donut stage, which went around the inside of the tent. And it was called Immortal the Gas Works. So I don't even remember a book for that one. But then consequently, ever since, you know, before and ever since, there's always been books. So 100 Years of Solitude when Taboo happened, and then that went for 3 years, and we were always still the same characters from the same book. Labyrinth, I don't specifically remember a book, but Bianco went all the way back to José Saramago. It was Portuguese, and it was The Elephant's Journey, just the tale of somebody taking elephants on a great big journey through cities. The king of Spain gives an elephant to the prince of Austria or something, and then a whole bunch of his courtiers have to take this elephant across Europe in the 18th century. And that was the concept of Bianco.
Oh.